From Community Public Radio, this is CPR Sunday. In New York, I'm Don DeBar with Eric Dreitzer from New York and Mark Sloboda from Moscow. So, wow, what a week. Let's see. We have a truce or ceasefire that's not a truce or ceasefire. It's a cessation of, I forget what, hostilities, bombing, whatever, in Syria.
Theoretically.
Theoretically. We've got...
not going to happen.
Right. We've got the Saudi and the Saudi planes ready to take off from Turkey to start flying into Syria. And I guess the Saudi ground troops are going to show up, whether it's by... being deployed there by changing uniforms on the ground. I think it's Mark's turn first this week, right? Am I right?
No, it's me,
it's
actually.
Eric's turn. Eric, shoot, yep. Lay it out for us.
Sure. Well, there's a lot of things to discuss here. I think just picking up our conversation from last week, obviously the major development probably for the entire last 12 months has been the recent encirclement of Aleppo and what seems to be the irreversible liberation of Aleppo from the hands of a variety of groups, some of them FSA connected, some of them Al-Qaeda connected, and the usual mélange of chaos that is the Syrian opposition, quote, so-called. So all of that is happening. Now, it's become quite clear that they have been officially cut off from their supply lines in Turkey. At least that's what we are told typically. However, recent developments, that is to say in the last 24 hours, indicate something else, and I think that this deserves some attention, and that is the fact that two high-ranking commanders in the so-called opposition or, you know, the various rebel terrorist groups have now confirmed that they have received what they call quote-unquote excellent quantities of Grad rockets. Okay, now, interesting thing about this is that up until this point, they have been whining and complaining that they have not received enough of precisely this sort of weaponry. And now that they're receiving it precisely at this moment, when supposedly they've been cut off from their supply lines, when supposedly we're moving towards some kind of a cessation of hostilities, I think that this is pretty interesting. There's obvious that command center that is on the ground in Turkey that is used for more or less command and control of these various factions by the NATO and Gulf and its Gulf proxies, that they are obviously directing these weapons in for the purposes of, well, I think they would say, allowing the rebels to defend themselves. The reality, of course, being to inflict more casualties, particularly on the Syrian Arab Army and likely on civilians as well. And I think that this is a really important point. In other words, that not only do they recognize the nature of the siege in Aleppo, but they understand that the siege is actually ultimately going to benefit them, that whether or not these rebels ultimately have to surrender, if they can extend this conflict, if they can deplete resources from the Syrian military and so forth, that this is going to benefit them in the long run and stall for time, presumably, to negotiate and also to inflict more casualties. So that's one point. But I want to also stress this. If you read the Western media reports about this, it's actually quite deceptive, because what they're actually saying, and I read in a couple of sources, in Australian mainstream Australian sources, CNN, a few other places, they're all using the same language, and that is that the Grad rockets are there for the purposes of quote unquote stalling the Russian military advances. Okay, now, there are no Russian troops on the ground, and these rockets are ground-to-ground rockets. They're not surface-to-air missiles or anything like this, so they're not actually there for the purposes of stalling the Russian advance. They're there to inflict civilian casualties and to inflict a toll on the Syrian military. Now, that deception in the Western narrative, I think, is critical, because it distorts the nature of the actual conflict, and also it it seems to more or less absolve the suppliers of these weapons from any responsibility for actually extending this war. So I think that that's one point, and I'll throw it over to Mark. I don't want to monologue too long, but I just want to also add that the other issue has to do with now in the last 24 hours, the reports that the Syrian military, along with its allies on the ground, those being the various Shia militias, be they of Hezbollah or Iraqi slash Iranian backed origin, that they are moving into Raqqa, into the Raqqa province. Now, this is a major development because, of course, Raqqa is the seat of Islamic State, ISIS, ISIL, Daesh power. It is the capital of the so-called caliphate. And it is really the heart of the, let's call it the extreme elements of this insurgency. And so if they're moving into Raqqa precisely at the moment that a so-called cessation of hostilities is agreed to, what this means then, I think, is that they're trying to make irreversible gains into the heartland of the Islamic State. In other words, to lay the groundwork for any potential future negotiation, ceasefire, and so forth. In other words, strengthening their position, weakening the Islamic State's position, cutting off their supply lines to Turkey, forcing the Islamic State to fight in a, you know, let's call it a one-to-one situation rather than one where the Islamic State is being backed by various international forces. And then, of course, the Saudis, this is part of the reason why the Saudis want in so badly. They are saying that they want to participate in counter ISIS, counter ISIL operations in Raqqa, but do they really? Or do they want to shore up the Islamic State in order to prevent it from being utterly obliterated by the advancing Syrian Arab army and its Russian allies? Lots of questions emerging in the last few days, all of them, I think, being distorted by the Western media.
Hey, Mark, I have another one because I'd like to unpack something. Mm-hmm. You know, we've just been reading in the media here about the NATO meeting and some of the changes that they've made in the way that NATO relates to the host countries along Russia's borders, that the relationship between the national army and NATO's command structure is, you know, is very interwoven. So I'm looking at the Saudis taking off from a Turkish base, but isn't that a NATO base? I mean, aren't Turkey's acts in supporting with infrastructure that belongs or is incorporated into NATO, isn't that an act of NATO?
Yeah, I mean, NATO, when countries act with NATO and its member states, they often try to put on their NATO hat one day and take off their NATO hat another day and say, now we're operating under the aegis of NATO. And then perhaps if Germany doesn't agree, they often use the very same protocols, the same communication structures that they would under NATO, just without those countries involved, you know, a handful of countries involved, and say it's not NATO. But you have to accept that NATO, sure, as a defense organization, which is far more than a defense organization, as it has never actually been used in defense and only has ever been used in out-of-theater military, you know, they call them interventions, invasions, occupations around the world. It has only ever been used as an aggressive alliance, only.
It's the Euro-American Imperial Army, basically.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I am a U.S. military veteran. I have served in NATO ops to my chagrin, and I can entirely say that. Now, you, of course, run into the fact that NATO is far more a political organization than it is a military organization, because the gulf between U.S. military capabilities and military scale and the NATO allies in Europe is so huge as to render the Europeans little more than, you know, political accessories to anything that the United States does. You know, the Brits may chime in with it with an occasional airstrike and a couple of special forces in too. But you know, let's not delude ourselves into thinking that the rest of Europe is deploying any serious military capability. I want to touch on something that Eric said. First, I have no disagreements with anything he said, so I'll just build on it. One thing about grads, these are multiple rocket launch systems. They are entirely indiscriminate weapons. They are banned by many countries in the world, and it is technically a war crime to use them against civilian areas, anything that is an urban environment where a large number of people live. And we have seen the West-backed government, the regime in Ukraine, use them extensively against the cities of Donbass.
Exactly.
They are city flatteners. That is what they do. They flatten blocks, you know, turn them into to rubble. And the fact that you know, these insurgents, whether it be the proxies for the Central Intelligence Agency or the much larger Islamist and jihadist forces that they are embedded with, as the Washington Post, the New York Times, everyone basically acknowledges at this point, in their hands, being used against Syrian cities, of course, is a new level of escalation. This goes beyond anti-tank missiles or anything of the sort, and large numbers of Grad rockets in their hands is only going to lead to vastly increased suffering of the Syrian people. I can't underscore how significant a development threats from Saudi Arabia that it will invade the sovereign territory of Syria, not just with air forces, but ground troops. And they're talking about extremely large numbers of ground troops. The U.S. Secretary of Defense, the U.S. is obviously fully on board and has said that they support Saudi moving illegally into Syrian sovereign territory without any Security Council resolution to that effect, under the pretext of combating ISIS. Ashton Carter, the U.S. Secretary of Defense, has said that United Arab Emirates will be sending forces, at the very least special ops. I guess the United Arab Emirates has special ops. I didn't really know that myself.
A couple of golf pros with guns.
Yeah, golf pros. Bahrain has said, or it has been claimed by Saudi Arabia that Bahrain will as well. Bahrain then replied, no, that's not really what we meant. And there seems to be a disagreement about that, whether Bahrain will be sending. And it has to be remembered that Bahrain is a tiny little Sunni monarchy dictatorship with a majority Shia population that a couple of years ago had to invite the Saudi army into their country to put down their own protesting population.
Most importantly, if I could just add, and I'm sorry, the U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is located in Bahrain.
That's the largest population.
That is really the significant point for people to know about Bahrain. Go ahead.
Yes, and the army is next door in Qatar, which will, of course, be a part of all of this as well.
Yeah.
The Russian military has indicated that they see, has very loudly proclaimed that they see signs of the Turkish military also preparing for an invasion of Syria. This would, of course, be directly cooperating with the Saudis, and that's with the Saudis operating out of Turkish air bases and them announcing military drills together. Russia, Turkey, NATO are all part of the Open Skies Treaty, and Turkey has denied previously scheduled air flights over their territory to Russian observer flights. Russia has called this extremely unprofessional and meant to hide the buildup of Turkish forces on the Syrian border.
Right.
So there's a lot of questions about this. Does Saudi have the military capability to do so despite the hundreds of billions of dollars of arms that they have gotten from the U.S., the U.K., Canada, France, everyone in the last decade or so? They are quite high military spenders, either third or fourth in the world at this point. They're having a lot of problems putting down in their attempted conquest of Yemen what is the poorest country in the Middle East, fighting people that are, you know, the majority of people are a little bit more than, you know, armed with AK-47s and wearing sandals. Right. And they have to bring in thousands of Colombian and Sudanese mercenaries to do the actual ground fighting for them. So there's a real question about the military capability of Saudi Arabia and Turkey. But of course, with the forces of the Syrian government and the Hezbollah, the support of militias already stretched so thin, fighting a whole host of different jihadist groups, rebels, and ISIS on top of this, they certainly don't need the extra stress of thousands of Saudi and Turkish troops invading. It would probably lead to, you know, a quick collapse in whatever troops areas these troops moved into. And there's a real question of whether Russia would engage with them or not. Will Russia at this point enter into a war with a NATO member Turkey or Saudi Arabia in order to defend Syria? And
let me ask you
I don't know whether – I can't make an accurate assessment at this point if they will, because the Russian government has made a lot of very strong statements, but they are in the end – have proven somewhat cautious and pragmatic such things that could obviously lead to a world war.
Yeah, there's no real strategic advantage to them engaging earlier rather than later in this particular theater. I mean, there's nothing, no ground is in play, no assets are really in play until there's actually a major engagement. Now, I got a question, though. I've been, you know, it's kind of a humorous image that I'm using, I've been using, and I intend to do that, you know, to make a little chuckle. But, you know, the idea of the Saudis announcing that they are bringing troops into Syria, essentially, does give the opportunity for Saudis that are in Syria now, as this thing gets deconstructed, to have their own uniforms on and say, oh, well, we were part of the invasion force, now we'll leave. Is it possible that they're constructing this so they have a way to get their jihadis out without them getting massacred in Syria?
Oh, I don't think what we're going to see is them moving them out. I think what we will see instead is a large number of jihadis and very likely ISIS personnel as well simply disappearing and withering away and appearing in Saudi, Qatari, Bahraini, UAE, and whatever else uniforms as part of the coalition against terrorism, or at least the U.S.'s rather hypocritical coalition against terrorism.
Yeah,
I think that's the real danger.
It's a rebranding. It's a rebranding attempt,
I
think.
Yeah. But I'm wondering about the intent of it, Eric. I'm wondering, are they doing it, in other words, to engage now we're Saudis and we're here and we're engaged and we're fighting ISIS, that's why we're blowing up the Kurds? Or are they looking for an exit strategy so they can deconstruct the mess that's there? Maybe some agreement.
I don't think they're looking to deconstruct the mess. I think they're looking to deconstruct Syria.
Yeah, exactly.
Still, that's the goal.
I mean, that's the Brookings Institution. That's all of the neocons. That's what they've been driving
at. I know. That's the purpose of this up to this point, but nothing changed.
Do yourself a favor. Go online. Go to the Brookings Institute website.
I know this. Deconstructing
Syria.
I feel like I reference it every week.
I get that part. I'm saying, though, nothing happened Friday in these negotiations. There wasn't really any kind of a backroom watershed where they agreed to deconstruct it. That's what I'm asking.
well deconstructed. I think that I don't know. It's possible that there were backroom negotiations about that, but not even really negotiations so much as just, you know, strategizing. But here's what I really think about this, and I want to be clear about a couple of points. I was really heartened to hear Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov made a comment in Munich that I thought was really significant. Now, some people, you know, have taken issue with it. Some people who claim to be, you know, pro-Syria take issue with this. But I think he's 100% right. I think he said very clearly, look, war crimes are being committed every single day on all sides on the ground. And that is a fact. Yeah. And the demonizing of Assad is for purely propagandistic reasons. In other words, what he's saying is exactly what Mark was getting at, that something like Grad rockets, which are indiscriminate, whose use is a war crime, is in fact no different from the much dreaded, much propagandized barrel bombs. And that is a major point that the Russians are making. In other words, that you can't build an entire narrative around atrocities committed by Assad unless you're going to point out that all of your so-called rebels, from the quote-unquote vetted moderates to the extremists, are committing war crimes every single day. In other words,
you can build that narrative, but it doesn't have any legitimacy.
Right. It's a distortion of reality is what Lavrov is saying. And I think I don't know if that's, you know, maybe I've missed it when that's previously been said, but that's one of the first times I've heard that statement. And I thought that was really important, because that means then that now we're getting into, I think, a territory for negotiation where we have a real honest discussion about the reality on the ground and about what kinds of steps need to be taken in order to de-escalate the scenario. Now, coming back to the deconstruction question, I think that this is also very significant. I don't believe, first of all, I obviously don't believe the Saudis are trying to get into Syria in order to fight the Islamic State. That's just silly on its face. But I also don't necessarily believe that the idea is to use this as a cover to withdraw their forces. I think what they want to do is they want to be able to shore up Raqqa as a stronghold for the Islamic State and some of these other extremist groups, with the idea, with the intent, that the deconstruction model is going to include these various enclaves that are going to be controlled by certain proxy forces. They would like to be able to carve out an enclave in the south. They would like to be able to carve out an enclave in the northeast. They would like to be able to carve out these different pieces of Syria and be able to put them into the hands of their favored proxies. Now, that can't be done if the Russians are backing with air power the Syrian Arab army advancing into Raqqa. That's simply impossible. They won't be able to hold that territory indefinitely. That's why the Saudis are coming to the rescue for Daesh. That's why the Turks are desperate to get ground troops into Syria as well. It's not because they want to fight terrorism. It's not because they want to necessarily win, quote unquote, outright win this war. Both of those things are out of the question. They're off the table. What they want to do is be able to move forward with the deconstruction. And the only way they can do that is militarily at this point, because Russia, I think, has obviously demonstrated that their goal, aside, you know, whatever the Western propaganda wants to say, you know, shoring up Assad, you know, propping up his regime, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What the Russians really want is they want a stable and unified Syria. That's what they desperately want. And that's what the West is playing at, I think, here. And again, it has to be said that all of these developments of recent weeks and recent months, I think, have fundamentally changed the character of this war, such that now you see all of this interest in a humanitarian refugee question, all of these various mouthpieces, be they NGOs and so forth, are all turning up the propaganda about the refugees. Now, obviously, the refugees fleeing from Aleppo, very, very tragic, and I 100% reject anybody who calls all of these people terrorists, who calls all of them, you know, collaborators and traitors and whatever. This is absolutely irresponsible and I think totally discredited way of looking at the issue. Many of these people were trapped in Aleppo. Many of them couldn't get out. Some of them elderly. Some of them families of people who picked up guns to fight the government. You know, you can't pinpoint them all as one or the other.
And Churkin said this at the UN too.
But what we can say, though, is that this issue is being used and utilized for the purposes of legitimizing an intervention from Turkey and an intervention from Saudi Arabia. And then at the larger level, of course, the U.S. NATO narrative.
Selective.
I think that that is very important.
Yeah, it's selective. And that's what Churkin said at the at the UN the other day when he described exactly what you just said in the last piece there. And that's exactly what he said. He pointed to this city and this city and this city where all these things have happened, but they were being done by the people backed by the U.S. and the Saudis, et cetera. And so it just didn't happen.
And you never saw any human rights organizations.
Nope.
In fact, just north of Aleppo, there were two small cities that have been just in the past week liberated by the Syrian Arab Army. They were literally under siege by al-Qaeda, al-Nusra, for 3 years.
Yep.
And they had to fly in food and other supplies.
The Syrian Arab Army, by the way.
You never hear the U.S. government crying for those Syrian people.
That's
you
right.
never heard Human Rights Watch crying for those people.
That's what Jafari
said. Starvation siege.
I
agree with everything that Eric said about the refugees in particular coming from Aleppo. But we have to clear up a little bit of distortions that are being presented about the exact situation in Aleppo by the Western press, as if it is some rebel city that is being attacked by the Syrian government and Russia, rather than a portion of Aleppo which has been taken and held hostage literally by al-Qaeda and a whole host of other groups that are aligned with it, including brigades of the so-called West-backed Free Syrian Army, who openly ally and cooperate with them. But there are – before the war, Aleppo was Syria's largest city. It is now their second largest city, and the pre-war population of about 3 million or so. Currently – there are about 2 million people, according to the Western press here, according to the Washington Post, New York Times, living in government-controlled portion of Aleppo. Now, the numbers about how many people are living in the quote-unquote rebel-held portions of Aleppo, the al-Qaeda-held portions of Aleppo, vary in the reports I've seen, between 40,000 and 250,000. Any way you look at it, that is a tiny fraction of Aleppo that is already held by the government forces. And you're certainly not going to see those 2 million people fleeing Russian airstrikes targeting selected buildings held by al-Qaeda in the northern section, or when the Syrian Arab Army starts going door to door with Hezbollah to clear out these terrorist held areas. So there is a refugee problem. It is very real, and no, not all of these people are terrorists or sympathizers necessarily, but the scale is being presented as if millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people are going to go running because of this to the Turkish border. But the numbers involved are actually much smaller. Much of Aleppo has been in government held hands all along. And this is only a portion of the city of Aleppo. And we have to remember that ISIS forces are also in the eastern outskirts of Aleppo. The suburbs and so on. So they're engaging with the government forces there as well.
I only brought it up because I just want to, for the purposes of the kinds of discussions we have here, is to cut through, I think, distortions and certain kinds of rhetoric that is problematic.
Deconstructing the Western narrative.
Deconstructing the Western narrative. Yeah, also, I think that we have to be cognizant of the various aspects and the various sides that have been taken. For instance, there are people who are fleeing Aleppo right now who have never engaged in any of the war, but who maybe have a son or a brother or a cousin who did. And they know perfectly well that they can't flee to government territory because they are seen as on the wrong side of the war. And this is one of the major problems with, I think, some of the narratives that we have about this conflict, because
and
a lot of people
versa.
And vice versa. And I think that a lot of people get caught up in a sort of cheerleading one side or the other and totally discounting a lot of the experiences that real people are having. Because, you know, if you watch some of the videos of people coming out of Aleppo, including a couple that I saw with translations, you know, that is the impression. That is the impression that you begin to see from a lot of these people. Like, what do you want us to do? Where are we supposed to go? We can't flee to here. We can't go here. So now we're stuck. You know, and that is a very real experience that a lot of these people have. That's why I wanted to bring that up, so that we have a well-rounded picture of all of this, because everything that Mark has said is accurate, including the questions about the numbers. But of course, if we're talking 50, 100,000 people, that's still a massive number of people, and we have to be very clear about what their situation really is.
Let's point out that Turkey has still sealed the border to these refugees fleeing from Aleppo. They're not prohibiting the rebels' reinforcements, supplies going back and forth across that border. But they are still holding these refugees from Aleppo there for the express purpose of declaring a safe zone on Syrian territory and using that to prevent airstrikes on their proxies that will, of course, inhabit the same space, and to create this humanitarian pretext for them then to move into this territory.
This then becomes a major artery for Turkish arms, supplies, fighters, all of these things, using essentially refugees as human shields. I mean, ultimately,
yes,
that is really what's happening here. And again, it returns us to this point of, you know, these refugees are in a real bad spot.
For sure.
Now,
listen,
in the last few months, there were actually conversations in U.S. Senate hearings on what's going on in Syria. And you can go back. They're all archived on C-SPAN. They were all streamed and they're all recorded. And they were literally discussing the creation months ago about the creation of these safe zones. And they were talking about creating safe zones for the rebels, their proxies.
Yep. Right, that's right.
And it was only a few minutes into the conversation. It was then, we could also move the refugee. We would, of course, also move the refugees in so that the rebels couldn't be attacked.
The fact is, they've been having that conversation since 2012.
That's right.
That goes back. Yeah. I remember I forget if it was Brookings or if it was Rand Corporation. One of the think tanks, major think tanks, had that model laid out in early 2012 of the necessity of creating safe zones for the purposes of precisely this. At the time, though, the safe zone was supposed to be in tandem with a no-fly zone. Now, obviously, that's been off the table, and certainly since Russia got involved, that's really off the table. So now this is a sort of a recasting of that same strategic initiative.
But this was U.S. senators and U.S. military brass discussing it in that blatant terms.
On
a
TV.
Safe zone for rebels.
On TV.
And moving the refugees in to protect them.
On TV.
TV. Yep. Like, you can go to C-SPAN
right.
archives and watch it for yourself.
That's right.
I was just flabbergasted. And they don't even try anymore.
Sort of reminds me of Petraeus saying you need to arm Al-Qaeda before the Senate Armed Services Committee. Like, really? You're going to be that blatant about it? I mean, at least have the decency to be slightly use coded language.
Let me raise a question here, because I want to just settle.
I also want to bring up a separate subject.
Yeah, yeah.
To this.
We
go
got
ahead,
plenty
Tom.
Of time. So,
okay.
So
I want to bring up two other.
Back to the The jihadis on the ground suddenly becoming Saudi regulars, essentially, on the ground with a narrative to explain their presence. Okay, so we know that their plans are to, you know, continue to wage the war to the extent that they can, and they're preparing to step it up quite a bit. They're also suddenly, though, provided with a fallback position. I mean, they have assembled this huge jihadi army there, and they want to keep that resource no matter what happens in Syria. Shouldn't people on the other side be looking, like, shouldn't Syria, shouldn't Russia be looking at also, these guys are installing an exit strategy for these people if they decide they need it, as Saudi troops, basically. We're bringing Saudi Arabia.
I would imagine the Russians certainly and the Syrians know that. Now, the question, though, is what can really be done about this? I think that there's a couple of things. I think that the Russians, for their part, are not particularly interested in a direct war with Saudi forces. That would then force them into – look, I think that this is the goal here. The goal is to force the Russians into an outright war, and that's what the Russians have been avoiding.
That would, of course, be a war in the Black Sea against Turkey
It would be a major, large-scale war.
And lots of
not only that, look, they no matter what, prideful, comments or whatever are made from Russian people who, you know, are obviously in support of their government and so forth. I think from the U.S. perspective, they think they want to bleed Russia slowly if they can, using obviously depressed oil prices, using economic instability, the sanctions and all of these other things. Sure. And then on top of that, try to embroil Russia in a large scale war. I don't think that Putin or Lavrov or Medvedev or any of them are ignorant of that. I'm sure that they understand that perfectly. They're, some of their think tank people and the rest of them obviously know all of this. The question is, how does Russia really counter this? And I think that what I was mentioning earlier, the slow and steady advancement on Raqqa is really, I think, part of that strategy. And it's very interesting. If you noticed, probably the most positive comments about the cessation of hostilities, quote unquote, coming out of Munich were not from John Kerry. They were not from anybody on the U.S. or the NATO side. They were from the Russians. And I think that the Russians are using this to their benefit quite masterfully, if I could say that, in the sense that they want to be able to say, OK, we're going to have a cessation of hostilities. In the meantime, we're going to continue bombing ISIS and al-Nusra and the other terror groups that everybody recognizes as terror groups.
Right.
And on top of that, any other foreign forces that now intervene, i.e. cough, cough, Saudi Arabia and Turkey, you're now violating the ceasefire, the cessation of hostilities. You're the ones who are undermining all of this process. We are signatories. You are now invading. This is a way, I think, of flipping the narrative on who is an aggressor and who isn't, because that's really what the Western media has been trying to push on the Russian side all along, is that Russia is an aggressor. Russia is bombing civilians. Russia is killing people, you know, at will and so forth. The reality is Russia was just one of the leading forces behind a cessation of hostilities in which they openly acknowledged that they would not stop their bombings of ISIS and al-Nusra. So now if Saudi Arabia intervenes on the other side, who is really the aggressor here? I think that that is part of what they want to do. Now, Mark, if you want to add to that, you can. But
before you go on to that, on the same point, the narrative can sustain basically a fact pattern of the jihadis that are being targeted legitimately by Russia suddenly having Saudi uniforms and the Russians bombed Saudis.
That of course is an increasing danger. Again, Russia doesn't want to get involved in a war with Saudi and Turkey, which, first of all, Turkey is a NATO member. There's always the question of whether Article 5 in such a situation can actually be invoked or not, because of the geographical restrictions placed on it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, as we've seen with the IMF, the rules are quickly shifted around to whatever advantage have them. We've seen this type of rebranding activity already taking place with the attempted merger of al-Nusra, al-Qaeda, with its offshoot, Ahrar al-Sham, by moving al-Qaeda's, dissolving them and moving them under the brand of Ahrar al-Sham, which is really just as an egregious a group, but which the U.S. media has tried, and institutions like Brookings in particular, I'm looking at Charles Lister, have tried to rebrand as moderates when they are they want the exact same Islamic State for Syria that ISIS does. They just want a different Islamic State. Right.
My Islamic
with them.
State.
Well, yeah, but yeah, my Islamic State with right. me in charge.
Right.
You said a slow and steady advance to Raqqa. I don't think we it can't be a slow and steady advance to Raqqa. It is a race to Raqqa at this point, because if the Saudi and Turkish troops ensconce themselves on the ground there, that is territory that we don't know if the Syrian government will ever then get back. And a lot of that territory out there is where Syria's oil is.
Oh, what a
this is where ISIS is. This is where the Syrian oil fields are. So not only does the Syrian government lose its territory, but it loses its primary source of revenue to Saudi Arabia and, you know, whatever proxies it has there.
Right. Well, I just want to clarify. I meant slow and steady, meaning between now and the so-called beginning of the cessation of hostilities. Obviously, that conflict continues for a long time because Russia and the others have said very obviously they're not going to stop the fight against ISIS no matter what the cessation of hostilities is. So, you know, that fight continues slow and steady, meaning between now and March 1st.
Just real briefly, we haven't touched on it before, but Eric talked about it, and I want to bring it out about the oil prices, because this is the geoeconomic warfare aspect of what is going on. This Saudi overproduction, OPEC, in order to vastly drop oil prices around the world, is very deliberate. There has been a fiction that it was done against over market share with U.S. shale company, which were never any threat to Saudi market share around the world. It's absolutely ridiculous.
A lot of the same ownership anyway.
Yes. It is geoeconomic warfare against Russia and Iran.
And Venezuela.
Venezuela's a side target. It benefits the Americans. It doesn't really help the Saudis that much. Certainly they suffer from it perhaps worse than the others. But a very interestingly aspect of this is, at least from the Russian position, we know that Iran has weathered this for years now without being able to sell large quantities of oil because of sanctions. So they've survived that. Russia has been playing a game of chicken with Saudi Arabia over this, because they've been outproducing Saudi Arabia now.
Race to the bottom.
It doesn't make much sense, except when you think about how Russia stopped defending the ruble and let the price of the ruble vastly deflate, and that Russia is paid for the oil they sell abroad in dollars or other foreign denominated currency, which puts huge amounts of money into the Russian benefit. What this actually does is it transfers the costs to the Russian people, but only in the sense of them buying Western goods and stuff, which of course only acts as another form of counter sanctions on tourism and goods on Europe as well. It's a very, very intelligent strategy, actually. And Russia is not blinking in this the geoeconomic aspect of the war. And lastly, I just want to touch we haven't mentioned that Britain has also moved 1,800, nearly 2,000 troops openly into Jordan under the pretext of war games to defend Eastern Europe from Russia. I don't really understand that argument. So they're already staged in the area.
Got to prepare for desert warfare in Eastern Europe.
Desert warfare in Eastern Europe. So they're already staged to be a part of all of this. As well, the U.S. has announced that it is sending two brigades of the 101st Airborne into the Syria-Iraq theater. The 101st Airborne, of course, is a storied U.S. military unit. They have been the vanguard of every U.S. invasion of occupation for the last 30-some years. And they were also the ones whose members were involved in a lot of war crimes, atrocities in both Afghanistan and Iraq as well.
I just wanted to go back a minute, because when you're talking about the game that they've been playing with oil, Russia's been playing with oil, you now have also this call by some in the government. I saw it in Pravda somewhere yesterday. Sputnik.
Okay, don't read anything in Pravda.
Or Sputnik or whatever. No, I understand. Definitely. I know how to look at it critically. There was an official in the government, I think it was Sputnik, that said that they're looking at dumping the dollar as a reserve currency.
Maybe I'm cynical, but I've seen that story so many times. Understood. For actually 7-8 years and running at
40,
this point.
40.
I'm not buying it, frankly. In theory, in 20, 30 years, they would like to move to that. The Russians and the Chinese talk about it a lot. They're building out some of the infrastructure to allow them to do that. Certain exchanges are now being conducted in indigenous currencies. All of that is true. Moving away from the petrodollar as a global reserve currency, let's be serious. That's not happening anytime soon. That requires a massive reinvention of the global economic system.
Yeah, so I think it'll happen a lot
sooner than that. I think it'll happen in 10 to 15 years.
But it's maybe.
And the transition will be over time. But it's certainly not going to do it right now when Russia is doing everything it can to juggle under the low oil prices, the sanctions, and still being able to fund its budget and the military modernization, which has benefited it so much in Syria.
There's a major development, and I'm taking the initiative to shift gears here. There's a major development in Lebanon that we need to be very clear about and very aware of, because it has a ramification not only for Syria, it really has ramifications for the whole region, and that is the rebirth or resurgence of the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon. This is a huge development, in my opinion, one that is going totally under the radar. I have to give credit where credit is due. This is from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, Raphael Lefebvre. So we also, I think, know what the Carnegie Endowment is, but we also know that great information does come out of there about a lot of different things. So very interesting. A guy named Azam Ayoubi, elected Secretary General of the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon, so-called Jama al-Islamiyya. Now, why do I bring this up? Because this person and this faction within the Muslim Brotherhood is staunchly anti-Assad, staunchly pro-Islamists in Syria, and this person who was elected is much more hawkish on the issue, as he represents what could be called a much more vocal segment, particularly among the youth of the Islamist movement inside of Lebanon. Now, there's two things that we need to pay attention to here. Number one, of course, is the impact for Syria itself. They are now reinvigorating their financial campaign, meaning raising of money to send to, who knows, Ahrar al-Sham, the various other Islamist formations, Fatah and, all of the others, the Islamic Army of Conquest, all of them, right? So that's happening on one level. On another level, there is now this very real question about the dynamics between the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon and Hezbollah in Lebanon. In other words, now, is Hezbollah looking at a Sunni counteroffensive for political influence inside of Lebanon? Remember, Lebanon has been teetering on the brink of destabilization for quite a while because of what's happened in Syria. There have been terrorists flooding into Lebanon, seeking safe haven there. There are all kinds of connections between what's happening in southwest and western Syria and what's happening over the border in Lebanon, including including some of the internal conflicts. Now, again, this is a very real question. Are they opening up potentially a two-front war for Hezbollah? I think that that is sure. I think that is a very real possibility.
Absolutely.
Here.
Absolutely. I don't think now, there's any question.
Right. And so if you look at the statements here from Azam Ayoubi, the new Secretary General, and some of the people who are behind him, now the question is, are they an independent organization? I would argue no. Or are they part of the much larger Muslim Brotherhood network, which is rooted in Qatari and to some varying degrees Saudi influence, as well as some other parties? Now, this complicates the picture in Syria, of course, because if new support comes in to the West, especially to those rebel factions that are in control of some of the Damascus suburbs from the Alush organization, some of the other groups, if they're now going to get more support from Lebanon, does this now extend the war? Does this now foment the conflict? I think it obviously does. And I think it's intended to do precisely that. Now, the picture being portrayed of the internal dynamics here is quite interesting. In other words, the youth of the Islamist movement are in support of a more hawkish line. Is there now going to be fighters being recruited out of Lebanon? How much of this is going to impact? All of these questions, I think, for the most part, have gone unanswered.
Yeah, and I mean, there's also just the simple fact that Hezbollah, which are fighting in Syria, will of course be forced to send troops back home to shore up their own base in southern Lebanon, well, and which will draw troops away from the Syrian theater.
Well, and
regardless.
The interesting thing about that is that historically, the Hezbollah and the leadership of the Muslim Brotherhood in Lebanon, of the Jama'a al-Islamiyah group, they've maintained some level of dialogue, and they've more or less been able to kind of sort of coexist, despite the fact of the Sunni-Shia divide and all of the rest of that. But the issue to me is now that we see this development, does this mean that that dialogue process is basically ending, and now the Muslim Brotherhood are entering into the Lebanese parliament? They're now getting political power in, at a very small level so far, but that's only going to increase. This, of course, complicates the picture, and of course, it makes for, I don't know that Hezbollah is necessarily going to have to fight a war inside of Lebanon against them, but they're certainly going to have to fight a political war against them.
I think it was inevitable that the war extends to Lebanon, particularly if Damascus fell, but to jihadist forces, Lebanon would certainly be next. But, I think the spillover is, inevitable. Eric, you brought up Lebanon, and that brings me to mind of the problems that the Christians, the Orthodox Christians of Lebanon and both Syria are facing in this, because they've largely supported the Syrian government, because they know that they face, ethnic cleansing at best and genocide if the Islamist forces take Damascus. I mean, that was the chant from the beginning, the very first protests on Daraa, Alawites to the grave, Christians to Beirut. And we see the oddity of which most Westerners can't understand of Hezbollah, of Christians in Lebanon, largely siding with Hezbollah. But I think I know, you probably know where I'm going with this. There was another major geopolitical event this week when a 1,000-year religious schism in Christianity was ended, and the Russian Patriarch met with the Catholic Pope in Cuba, of all places, and began a dialogue. And one of the principal things they talked about was the need to defend Christians, Orthodox Christians in the Middle East, who have really been the biggest victims of the so-called Arab Spring and the Syrian conflict.
You've been listening to CPR Sundays with Eric Dreitzer and Mark Sloboda. I'm Don DeBar, your host. Look forward to seeing you drop in again next week. Thanks for listening.